The Public Relations Society of America's 2001 International Conference presents this live presentation, recorded for PRSA, in Atlanta, Georgia, in October of 2001. If you're listening to the audio tape format, at the end of Side 1, please stop the tape and turn to Side 2 for the conclusion of this presentation.
Welcome, welcome to part two of Behavioral Change Model and the Underpinnings. If you're just joining us now, I'm going to do a snapshot of just what we covered. We're not going to repeat it, obviously. Also to announce that some of you who wanted our handouts that we were distributing, We thought more than enough, but we didn't have more than enough. We had less than enough. So, again, use a business card thing. If you didn't get the handout, so you can get the folder. If you just write folder on it, we'll make sure you get everything that was distributed today. So we'll take care of that. We apologize for not having those. We had well over 100 or so, but just didn't have enough, which is great. We love that people are interested in and really wanting to practice this way. This morning, our first sessions, we really spent time on the behavioral public relations model. We went through that knowing that our desire is desired behaviors. If we don't shoot for those ultimate desired behaviors, we're not going to be successful as public relations. We know awareness is important. Awareness drives us as our first step. If we stop there, we have to answer the big so what to our clients and our organizations. Well, you got us in the media, so what? So we're going way beyond so what. We're going to the ultimate desired behaviors. And we talked this morning about how to do that by going direct to key stakeholders and also working and how to design the ultimate desired behaviors and the intermediate behaviors that we need. So now we know, again, our research tells us, we know where we want to focus, and that's on opinion leaders. So we're going to talk about that as our first session this afternoon. Then we'll cover the organizational family and localizing everything. Again, just a recap for those of you who may be just joining us. From time to time, we'll mention something because we didn't have enough time, even with a double session, to get all the information in. If we say, you know, if you want something, write it on your business card. We'll give you the words to use. Just jot it down at the end, give it to us, and we'll make sure you get a copy of whatever it is you're interested in. So we want to make sure we get back to you. And that's the easiest way for us. You come up and say, can you do something? We'll forget. You give us on a business card. We got your name correct and everything. We'll get it to you. Secondly, we're going to try to leave enough time at the end to do a really quick evaluation, a little research feedback session. It takes about 5 minutes. We'll ask you to participate in that. And, of course, there are the green evaluation sheets that PRSA distributes. We encourage you to do that because we know that research and evaluation are the two beginnings and ends of all of our work, so we want to get the evaluations. At this time, I'd like to introduce our next presenter, and that's Robin Schell, APR. Robin is senior counsel with Jackson Jackson Wagner, and we sort of have a trend going on here. Robin's been with us for 17 years. Again, you wouldn't believe it just by looking at her, but she has been around that long with the firm. She works on many of our major clients throughout the country, is able to get in very quickly. And one of the great skills that Robin has is to empathize with the company, with their organization, with the people in that, and then quickly move them on a strategic path to address what they want to do. She's a superb counselor in that sense. She has a lot of experience in coalition building, in working through issues, stakeholder relations. She's done a lot of stakeholder building and also with the rest of us works on crisis work as well. So at this time, Robin Schell is going to address opinion leaders.
Thank you, Pat. Can everybody hear me okay back there? I think we've got this microphone working. Well, today I want to talk a little bit about opinion leaders because it's our belief that building relationships and maintaining relationships with opinion leaders, that's some of the most important things we do as public relations practitioners on behalf of our organization. I'm going to talk a little bit about some observations about opinion leaders and then give you some models that will broaden your thinking, hopefully, about who exactly are these opinion leaders that we're trying to reach. The first thing I want to point out about opinion leaders, and I want to back up and make sure we know what I'm talking about when I say opinion leaders. By an opinion leader, we mean somebody who is a trusted and credible source of information on a particular topic or issue. So when we've been talking about opinion leaders, I want to make sure that everybody knows what I'm talking about, someone who really is a trusted source of information. So the first thing that I really need to tell you about opinion leaders is that they're very important because, like the employees and other members of our organizational family, they are among the most credible third-party advocates that we have out there. In other words, we can go out there as an organization and say, we really think you need to adopt this stand on the issue, or we really think you need to vote this way on a particular vote, for example. But it really means so much more, as you know, coming from a third-party source that we have built a relationship with that says, yes, this organization is on target. You should trust them. I believe in what they're telling us. So we have to remember the credibility factor for them. The other thing we need to remember about opinion leaders is that they will vary from issue to issue. So you can't just go out there and say, I'm going to get to know this little group of people, and that's going to cover me for everything. You need to know that there are opinion leaders on healthcare issues that are going to be different from opinion leaders on environmental issues, that are going to be different from opinion leaders on educational issues. And so if you're an organization that has lots of those different issues, you need to be thinking about, are we reaching the right opinion leaders for this particular situation? Now, another thing about opinion leaders, and I know some of you who have tried to push through some internal policy changes and those kinds of things will back me up on this, that opinion leaders exist both inside and outside your organization. I think when we tend to talk about opinion leaders, we tend to think, all right, who's out there in those stakeholder groups that we need to get to? Let's not forget that within our very own organizations, there are those opinion leaders, those movers and shakers, you know who they are, that you know you need to get to first when you're trying to do something and achieve some kind of change internally. So those are a couple of broad observations. Now I want to talk to you a little bit about the types of opinion leaders that are out there, because I think that our first tendency when we talk about opinion leaders is to talk strictly about what I would describe as a power leader, people that we know are in specific elected official positions. And I want to expand your thinking on that just a little bit by showing you this model, and I'll take them one by one. The first type of opinion leader is what we call the role model. These are people who are already out there giving you the behaviors that you want. They're already out there talking positively about your friend, things that you're doing to your friends and family. They're perhaps out there writing a letter to the editor on your behalf. They're doing the kinds of things we want them to do. We talked about the desired behaviors before. So what we want them to do is to keep on giving us those behaviors, and we want to reinforce that in any way possible. The second two types I'm going to talk about simultaneously, because there's one key difference between the two. There's true opinion leaders, and there's what I would call the power leaders. And the power leaders are people who are typically in some kind of decision-making or some kind of elected official position. And those folks are important people to know, as we know. The one difference between them and the true power leader or the true opinion leader is that the true opinion leader doesn't have a stake in the outcome of the issue. Okay, so they can do what Isabel was talking about earlier. For those of you who saw her presentation, they can take in all that information and make their own mind up, and they can go either way on the issue. There's no stake in it for them, no matter how they go. Whereas the power leader sometimes has some problems. They tend to be a little bit more wishy-washy on issues because they need to go perhaps with the tide of public opinion if they want to keep their elected position. So those are the two differences between those two categories. The fourth category is the cheerleader. And I think we've all met the cheerleader. It's somebody who can really bring a lot of visibility and attention to our issue because they can make a lot of noise about it. They might not necessarily be the most credible people on this particular issue, but they can rally the troops and they can make a lot of noise on it. And the fifth category is the celebrity. And I don't know how many of you have dealt with this in your professional life, but sometimes when a celebrity will glom onto your issue, that will cause that issue to rise to the spotlight. And sometimes you want to do this intentionally. For those who live in the New England area and know the football player Doug Flutie, he has an autistic son, so he has been associated with autism as a cause, and they've been able to use that to really bring some visibility on the communications on autism because he's got a direct tie-in. I know in a situation we were involved in Long Island, we had Alec Baldwin. For those of you who know Alec Baldwin, took a real interest in environmental issues, and so his involvement really brought the spotlight on those environmental issues. So that's a little bit about the types of opinion leaders. Now I want to get you thinking about, well, what do these people look like? What are their characteristics? What kinds of things should we be looking for when we talk about opinion leaders? The first one's pretty obvious. They have got to have an interest in your issue. They're not going to engage with you on any kind of two-way exchange if it's something they're not interested in the first place. So that's an absolute given. They've got to have that. Second thing is they've got to have some kind of a following. They need to be people that rub elbows with other folks, move in circles of other influentials that will ultimately have some kind of impact on the decision makers that we're trying to reach. The third category, they tend to be positivists. And again, these are kind of generalizations, but they tend to be folks that see the glass as half full as opposed to half empty. They seem to have that kind of positive energy, if you will. They tend to be activists by nature, and by that I don't mean, you know, they're chaining themselves to the gates. By that I mean they tend to be people who want to identify some solutions to some problems and get some stuff done. So that's the kind of people they are. They're activists by nature. The fifth point is that they tend to get around, and you'll notice we have get around in quotes, by not going anywhere. And I just want to share a couple of examples on that. One would be the CEO's executive assistant. That person rubs elbows and comes into contact with lots of people without even leaving his or her chair, correct? That would be one example of someone who gets around. Another one, I'll use an example that Pat Jackson used to use all the time. He always talked about the city of Indianapolis. And some years ago, the city of Indianapolis was named, and I hope we don't have anyone from Indianapolis here, but it was named one of the most boring cities. And the mayor was a little upset about that, and he said, we've got to do something about this. So he got together all the taxi cab drivers. And he got them together and said, how'd you like to make a little extra money? And they said, that'd be great. So he ended up doing a thorough training of those taxi cab drivers, telling them everything there was to do from a recreational standpoint, culturally, all the high points of what was happening in Indianapolis. And sure enough, you got a cab, you flew into Indianapolis Airport, you got in a cab, the first question you'd get was, have you ever been here before? And if, God forbid, you said no, that taxi cab driver would just let loose with everything there was to do in Indianapolis. And sure enough, they were able to turn things around over time and become one of the most desired places to live as opposed to one of the most boring cities. So that was very creative targeting of an opinion leader group that you might not have gone and enlisted right away. You wouldn't think taxi cab drivers would be on that list. The sixth point is that they have credibility. They have to have some kind of credibility in order to be considered an opinion leader. People have to believe and trust in what they are saying. So just a little bit to broaden your thinking about who your own opinion leaders might be, I want to talk a little bit about how we find these people. There are two major ways that we know to find these people, and the first way is through something called a sociometric poll. And what you can do is you can just put the question out there, whether you're out there in some kind of omnibus survey or you've got some kind of survey going on, you say, on the subject of X, who do you consider to be a trusted source of information? And pretty soon, all that data will come back, and you'll find that the same names and titles and perhaps organizations where some of these opinion leaders congregate tend to start to rise to the top, and then you'll be able to really target who you're talking about in terms of opinion leaders. So that's one way. The second way is what we call working the network backwards, and that is to go to some of the folks that you already have some kind of relationship with, and we've certainly done this when we've worked with clients. We've We've started with a list of people that they already know, and we have asked the question as we're interviewing one-on-one, who else should we be talking to on this particular subject, or where else do you get your information on this subject? And we are able to expand that network of opinion leaders in that way. So that's a little bit about the types and the characteristics and how to find some of these opinion leaders. We also, I don't have time to go into it today, but we have a lot of information on how do we keep track of these opinion leaders. We have some systems for doing that, so if you're interested in that, you can write opinion leaders on your business card, and I'll be happy to follow up with that. But I want to just share with you a case that I was personally involved with, and some of you may be familiar with Brookhaven National Laboratories. A few years ago, they had a little problem. In 1998, they had a tritium leak, and that, we talked about triggering events before, that really served as the triggering event for them to say, hey, we have got to do something about our environmental reputation. And it really caused them to say, we have got to reach out into the community and build lots of relationships with these opinion leaders, and we've really got to change our whole approach from kind of a closed organization to a more open and involving the public type of organization. So we began with them with some opinion leader research. That was the first thing we did. And JJNW was involved both in the strategy for the whole program long term and also lots of the research. But we started with opinion leaders for a couple of different reasons. Number one, for the reason that I just talked about before, that we wanted to start with the folks that they already had some relationships with and help them to expand that opinion leader network to be able to identify who are some other people, not just their friends. We needed to talk to some of the people in some of these activist groups that had formed and some of the other folks and really expand their network. So we did it for that reason. Also, in this particular case, we did it because the feedback we got from the original opinion leader interviews helped us build a more formal research instrument where we had to go out and do some measurement, some baseline community research, and that in this particular case was required from some reporting that had to be done to the DOE. So we started with that. I will say, and Pat Jackson talked about this for those of you that are at luncheon, and he talked about how you can't just do relationships overnight. It takes time to do. Well, it took them about 3 years to really turn their environmental reputation around. It was a lot of hard work. Part of what they had going for them, they had a terrific community and public involvement staff, and they also had the commitment of their leader. Dr. John Marburger was the lab director, and he was one of these people that was completely committed to building the relationships with even those folks that didn't necessarily see the issue eye to eye with them, and he would go to their community advisory group meetings every month and listen to these people. So it was a long period of trust building, but it did, in their particular case, pay off. They were actually named just this past year by the International Association of Public Participation as Organization of the Year. So they came a long way in a relatively short period of time. And if anyone's interested in the particulars on that, I do have a little case study on that that I'll be happy to give to you. So you just write BNL on the card, and I'll be happy to send that to you. So that's a little bit about opinion leaders, and now I want you all to put your thinking caps on as we go to our small group discussions, and we talk about the stakeholders that you have already identified. The question for you is, how would you identify and or add to the list of opinion leaders, those groups or perhaps individuals who could directly or indirectly influence your stakeholders? So think about a current situation perhaps you're working with. How would you add to that list? What would you change, maybe divide down into some kind of subcategories of opinion leaders? And we'll all be helping to chip in on that conversation.
And presenting with us this afternoon as well is Dr. Lois Sekarak-Hogan, APR. Lois is senior counsel with JJNW. She's been with the firm well over a decade. With her doctorate in organizational development, Lois can diagnose weaknesses and obstacles and then develop effective tools to overcome those challenges. Lois also works with clients in a process we call building muscle, so that enables them to address some of the future issues without as much intensive work from us. So we like to work collaboratively with our clients. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hogan.
Thanks, Pat. We've talked a lot this afternoon about super-targeting audiences and about opinion leaders. And one of the key audiences in both of those categories for just about any kind of public relations goal that you're wanting to work on is the employee audience. While there are many different members in our extended organizational family, employees are one of the most important ones because they have so much credibility and can affect so many different things. As an example, internally, their behaviors, regardless of what we ultimately want them to do, their behaviors are essential to achieving productivity, to achieving innovation, quality, customer satisfaction, and adapting to change. Externally, we need these employees in many different ways because they, in fact, are internal opinion leaders. Sorry, I can't. Help me here, Pat. It's hand-eye coordination. I don't know. Which way? The other way. They are the credible parties that can really influence what our customers perceive our organizations to be, the neighbors and how they feel about what kind of things the organization is doing, communities, government officials, and many, many more. The problem is, before we can ask employees for anything, for any kind of specific behavior, it's important to first what we call kind of clear the decks, which means let's find out what's going on for them right now and what kinds of problems or needs or issues they may have. Because if we don't address those things first, we're very likely to hit a brick wall. Is this going to fit on here? When it comes to getting the kind of desired behaviors that we want from them. So, for example, if they don't feel they have enough training, if their software isn't working right, if their manager's giving mixed reactions, if their priorities aren't updated frequently enough, they may have so much going on in the background that it's going to be very difficult for them to kind of give you the kind of behaviors you want in support of your public relations plans and goals unless you've first kind of taken a look at these kinds of problems that may be on their plate. The way this relates to the model that Stacy introduced earlier this morning is that it's all about building latent readiness. If we're going to want some kind of behavior from our employees, first we have to build this latent readiness, and to do that means exploring what some of their needs might be. Now, we have a model for doing that we call What's in the Way, which really serves as a bridge. I believe you have this handout. I like PowerPoint a lot better. This is like beyond me. But What's in the Way is a conceptual model for helping us take our employees from a state of uncertain readiness to a state of where we know that they're more ready to deliver on the kinds of behaviors that we need from them. And basically, it begins by doing some research with them and asking them, well, what's going on? What's in your way? What do you need to be able to perform more effectively in the work that you have right now? We know from both psychology and from organizational behavior that when we don't ask these questions, we may only build resistance if we're then asking them to do something. And so it becomes very important to find an opportunity, to create an opportunity to really engage them and find what's in the way. The second part of taking them over the bridge is to have a session with the employees in which one thing that happens is a kind of catharsis. For some employees, they never get asked this question. And I mean, it's really amazing when you think they're the ones who do the work, but they never get asked, what's going on? What could you use that could make your job easier? So sometimes just asking demonstrates a level of management interest and concern that can really add to the degree of latent readiness that they have. But most important in this stage is the idea that you want them to collaboratively get involved in identifying what their needs are. Excuse me, because if you're not doing that, you're not getting the kind of buy-in and commitment that you need to get the kind of contribution to behaviors that you're asking them for. The next step would then be to bring them together and do some problem solving. After having identified what the problems, needs, opportunities are, the idea is to bring them together and have them prioritize those things, because you're going to, in many cases, come up with a very long list. And it's important to know what to tackle first. After prioritizing, then, is the collaborative decision-making process so that you can really solve some of the easier problems. We call it the low-hanging fruit, which builds momentum and it builds a certain confidence and credibility in your intentions. But then to also address the more complex problems, which may take more time, involve more people, but the point is not to throw anything away. So, and finally, the outcome of all of this effort is that we have built a degree of latent readiness. We have built some trust and some buy-in to the process. We have built what we call muscle, meaning that we have educated the people in a process by which they can, on their own, identify these problems in the future and not need an expensive consulting firm to come in and do that for them. If I can get to that when I get to the case example, I'll do that. Finally, is this idea of readiness for change. If we want employees to act on any kind of specific goals in our public relations plans, we have to move them over the bridge to this state of readiness. So let me illustrate that with a case example. Here are some action steps. I think you have this handout in your packet. Excuse me. The client organization is a state teacher's retirement fund, about $65 billion in funds managed for 300,000 both active and retired teachers. And our specific client in this organization was the division that's responsible for all the member benefits. So this means it's the people who cut the checks, it's the people who man the call center, it's the people who actually consult with the teachers about their retirement options and their plans. They have direct contact with the members. And this client organization was just facing a landslide, thank you, a landslide of changes. Most significant of which is that because of the demographic baby boomer bulge, the number of retired teachers over the next 5, 6, 7 years was going to just mushroom, meaning that their system was going to be strained by many, many more retiring teachers as well as new teachers coming into the system. And this just meant all kinds of changes. Now, commensurate with this is the fact that the board of trustees for the organization had decided in their plans that they wanted to be the premier retirement system for state teachers in the country. For this division, what that meant was they had to deliver customer satisfaction to the max. So how do you deliver customer satisfaction in the face of all of the various kinds of changes that they were expecting? Staff increases, technological changes, all kinds of other changes. So our goal, if we think of that as kind of like the ultimate behavior, as Gail talked about, to deliver premier customer satisfaction, our goal became how to create an organization that was capable of continuous change, continuously adapting to all the various things that were inevitably going to come down the pike, and with that, continuous learning and continuous innovation. We also had a secondary goal in that we wanted to make them self-sufficient, going back to this idea of building muscle again. Because this is not something that you just go in and do, you know, once every 5 years. Ideally, this is a recurring process that you're doing on an ongoing basis, and we wanted them to develop the capacity to do that on their own. So, the first thing we did was to meet with the leaders and all the employees in the organization to kind of set the stage, to let them know what to expect. Can you fix that for me? To let them know what to expect, to talk about the kinds of changes that were probably going to occur, and to engage them in this process that we were going to initiate. The next step was we held a focus group with every single work team in the division. And in these focus groups, moderated by a counselor at JJ&W, we simply asked that question, what's in the way of you and your team doing your best work? Now, the beauty of a focus group for this particular situation is that it gets people talking together, and often ideas would come out on the table that they wouldn't have thought of if we had just done some kind of more private survey. So we had some collective discussion and wisdom going on. And it was deliberately designed so that none of the team leaders or supervisors or managers were present. So there was a lot of comfort in terms of their conversations. I will explain this step even though it's not on this model. An additional thing that we did, because you can augment this in many creative ways depending on what the needs of the organization are, we also designed what we call a culture audit, which was an instrument that probed kind of 10 very major cultural dimensions like leadership, communication, decision-making, participation, those kinds of things. And this gave us two very valuable things for the process. Number one, it was a complementary process to the social research of the focus group because it enabled each person to give a very private response. So if there were things they wanted to say that they felt was a problem with their work team that they couldn't say publicly with their fellow coworkers, this instrument gave them a way to do that privately and anonymously. The other advantage of adding the culture audit to this process is that it gave us some quantitative measures, which were very useful not only in terms of having a benchmark against which our future success could be evaluated, but it also gave us some ways to look at which groups assess themselves as having, you know, more problems, and how did different work groups compare to other groups within their department or other groups within the larger division. So it gave us a lot more information to work from. The third step is that we then had an individual problem-solving meeting with each of those work teams again. And in these meetings, we had the team leaders, the supervisors, and the managers present for each work team. So we kind of went up the hierarchy. And two advantages to doing that. Number one, the team members heard that the leadership heard what they had identified as problems. I've worked in a lot of organizations where people say it never goes up. You know, they never really hear or listen to what's going on. Well, this way, they're in the same room together. There's no doubt that they're hearing the truth, the unvarnished truth, in complete candor. Secondly, because this was a problem-solving meeting, the people were present in the room who had the authority to make immediate changes. And so in 90% of these problem-solving feedback meetings, we would leave with the checklist almost done, with very little left to do, which was immediate kind of solution to some of the problems that they had suggested. Now, there were some needs identified that were far more complex and broad scale than a particular work team could address. Things that were really cross-cutting, that affected many, many people within the division. So for these, on step four, we established some cross-cutting task forces. Each task force was comprised of about 10 employees, and they represented a number of different levels within the division and a number of different departments, so that we had truly universal representation on these task forces. And the goal was to make sure that whatever solutions that they were going to recommend would have the viewpoints of the entire division. It wouldn't be a management decision made in isolation of people on the front lines, but it would really have a lot of representation. Another one of the really positive outcomes of that was that there was a lot of involvement. I mean, we had so many people involved in this that they were able to act really as opinion leaders to other employees in the organization to really talk about the kinds of successes they were coming up with. Finally, step five, and this is a very important step, which relates to that idea of building muscle. We did some training to prepare the team leads for each one of these work teams to have these kinds of conversations with their work groups on a recurring basis. And this is really important because we find in many organizations that a lot of the training that's available in the organization doesn't get to what some people call the soft skills, but we know to be really much more important than that. So this was a training that involved communication and involved problem solving, collaboration, decision making, a lot of different things that would give these team leads the capacity to do this on their own. And this model actually is going to be the beginning of a more pervasive training that will go on and give them even more. This is an example too. There's too much in this to give you a whole lot of detail in just 10 minutes, but that's an example of another important element of the use of the organizational family, which is face-to-face training for supervisors so that we are not just communicating with our employees through written or email or, you know, that kind of medium, but that we're having a direct conversation where information can go back and forth and can then go upward as well. And to answer your question, we did all of this in about 6 months. And we could have 6 months. We could have accelerated it, but we were trying to work with the schedule of the organization. And we could have done it in 3. Yes. The division that we're talking about in this case is, it was about 160 at the time. It's now 220. I mean, this is how fast they're growing. So that, you know, almost a quarter of their organization wasn't even there when we initiated this process. Yes? Well, that's a question I can answer for you afterwards since I have just a few minutes. So let me finish this. If we get this done, I'll respond to that. What were the outcomes? Number one, we clearly identified and eliminated a whole list of barriers for each work group, and we have a very solid record of what's been done. Secondly, by having a participative process, we've really created some buy-in to how things are being managed and organized in this division, making them a whole lot more ready to take on the new things we're asking them to do about customer satisfaction. Thirdly, it really demonstrated management was sincere. This wasn't just another fix. This wasn't just another kind of research project. But we demonstrated that management was clearly committed to this in on a number of ways, by making the changes, by involving the people participatively, and giving them the latitude to come up with recommendations. Those are a couple of examples. And also, we really did build muscle for continuous change. We now have about 50 people who participated in task forces know a whole lot more about the other departments, and eliminating that kind of fragmentation and isolation that they had experienced previously. They understand how to think about things from another point of view now. They know some techniques for collaborative problem solving. Importantly, they also know that solving some of these problems are not easy, and that gives them a whole lot more empathy, I think, for what management has to go through when management is presented with, you know, an employee gripe about something. And finally, and importantly, it paves the way for all the kind of behaviors that we really need from these people in order to deliver the customer satisfaction that we ultimately want to deliver. So it paves the way for productivity and many, many other things. So the bottom line to this kind of what's in the way process is that if our public relations planning has identified goals in which we need employees to support us, whether it's speaking positively about something or handling customer calls in a certain way or responding within a certain amount of time, whatever it is that we need from people, if we haven't done something like this, we are less likely to get the kind of enthusiastic, helpful, supportive behaviors that we need from them. And the what's in the way process is one that really does work. Just real quickly to answer your question, this was done with a concern about budget. And so part of our strategy about task forces and lots of other things was really to build this muscle so that they can do it on their own, not only in the future, but to also use them even now. So for example, we supported the task forces by a consultant being present for one of their meetings a month. Just enough structure to give them the support they needed, but not so much that it was expensive. So That's as much as I can tell you at this moment without giving you budget information. Do we have time for questions? I don't think we do. Later. Okay. So thank you. If anybody has more questions, let me know.
We're going to deviate slightly from our model that we put up, and we're not going to have our table discussion at this point. We're going to have the next presentation, then we'll have a little bit longer time to, I think, talk about the whole model that we presented today. So the last part of our application is localizing everything. We've heard about the behavioral model, going to key stakeholders for desired behaviors through opinion leaders, using the organizational family, and now we're going to talk about localizing everything so it really drives it home. And to present that portion, I'd like to introduce Mike Jackson, APR Fellow, PRSA. I hope many of you were at the luncheon. You got a chance to hear Mike speak at that. Mike is senior counsel with JJ&W. And after a distinguished career with Dow Corning, Mike, did many things, but in recent years he was instrumental in helping the company communicate during its time of bankruptcy, and actually still call upon him to help them out. He retired from Dow Corning and joined Jackson Wagner to work with his brother, Pat. Mike works with companies faced with or dealing with bankruptcy. He has experience with that, as well as counseling corporate communications professionals and major organizations. In addition, Mike spent many years abroad in Japan with Dow Corning. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Mike Jackson.
Thanks, Pat. Can you hear me all right? Is that okay? As Pat mentioned, I did spend almost 39 years with Dow Corning. Wanted to spend a little time working with Pat. That didn't work out, as you know, unfortunately. But one of the reasons I wanted to do that was not only to work with Pat, but also many of the things that I learned from him over the years, I was able to put into practice. And they worked. And they worked at a company of about 9,000 people. And they worked well. And if you want to hear more about that tomorrow, I'm putting on a presentation at 11:15 to talk about a crisis management situation with Dow Corning and how that worked. We're going to talk now, as we talked about all the things you've gone through, we finally get down to localize everything and the five languages of PR, which are up here, public relations. And the first one is spoken, and it's about 50,000 years old. You heard today at the lunch and some of the legends talking about how probably the first person that went, oh, and the other person went, oh, that there was some communication, some relationship there, and they talked about that. There are no grammar, spelling, or rules necessarily with spoken communication. A good example of that, and I don't like to show any biases, but I happen to live in Michigan. I don't know if Pat said that, but there's a little school down there called Michigan State University, and you can always tell when they're interviewing somebody from Michigan State, because they say, you know, how'd the game go today? What was the most significant part of the game? How are you going to do next week against Michigan? We're going to whip their ass. I mean, you know, so there are no rules at all. And you can repeat in spoken communication. You can repeat, and that's often important to do. You can do that until the hearer understands. But be careful with that. Be careful when you're doing that. Again, remember to localize this. Bring this down to your publics that you're working with. And be very careful about that. You all remember the case of George Bush, not W, the other one, talking about no new taxes, no new taxes. And he repeated that mantra, and everybody believed it. And what happened? He raised taxes. And so the credibility really goes down the tube, and you can't have that when you're bringing this whole process together to localize it, bring it all together. We see that today, for example, a lot in the spoken communication, and while they're not seamless, they flow together from spoken to written, and often today, especially with the gathering methods we have, it can become the written word tomorrow. And you see that a lot today in the current situation we're in, when some member of the cabinet will utter something, and tomorrow it's the headline in USA Today or something. And what happens? There is a press conference, and Ari Fleischer is explaining what Rumsfeld really meant was. And so you've got to be careful of that. But the written language is one that, the spoken one is certainly one of the languages we need to do to bring this to the local audiences. The written public relations that we do, here probably 5,000 years old. You need to be careful here when you're writing something. Make sure that the people that are reading it understand what it says. Make sure it's clear. And what do you mean by clarity? You probably have heard the story of the the policeman that pulled over this woman, an old lady driving down the highway, just chugging along, and there's this whole stream of cars behind her, and they're honking their horns like crazy. And how do we get by this woman? So the sheriff comes up, pulls her over, turns the lights on, and he said, "Lady, you're holding up traffic. You're really driving way too slow, and you've got to observe the speed limit." And she says, "Well, I'm sorry, officer. The sign up there says 10. And he says, "No, that's Highway 10. And he's about to leave and says, "Please take care." And he looks in the back seat, and he sees these two women back there, and they're just shaking, shaking, shaking. And he says, "Is everything okay?" And she says, "It is now. We just got off Highway 149. So when you're looking at written communications, make it clear. Make it clear. And today that's so important, because using the electronic methods that we're all used to, you can get something out. And again, writing and talking about localizing everything, you need to be very specific about where that's going, because we all know it's as easy as hitting a button, and that may not go to 20 people, it may go to 20,000 people. If they took statistics, it's one of those courses they hated. But it's used a lot, and especially today, you see more and more of it, not only in the language of business, but in science, McPaper, USA Today. You'll see down the corner every morning, there is a little column that has some kind of statistic. You know, how many people eat bagels, how many eat bagels with cheese, and so forth. That, not that you care, but it's there, and they have a lot of that. And you do know that today. You see it a lot. You see it when you see in the paper or hear on the news the statistics about company X laid off 20% of your people. That gets your attention very quickly. So you start computing. What's 20% of this? What's 10% of that? So it's used more and more. Again, as you go through and look at localizing your whole communications process and your behavioral change you're going through with this process, make sure it's localized and targeted to that specific audience. I happened to work for a company for a long time that was a technical company, and of course these people love statistics, engineers, which is great. So we found it very, very useful in communicating with some of these technical kind of things. But be aware of your public. Know what it is, and know what is the best method to use there. The visual use of the language is very important. Steve Shavinsky, who's in our audience, will know this, and others of you from perhaps the Detroit area. It was a year ago or maybe 2 years ago that the Ford Motor Company had a major explosion at the Rouge plant. And the most visual tool they could use and the most visual thing that was important to that public, the public of the employees, the shareholders, the community, I think, was the picture of Bill Ford walking out there with a hard hat and going through that facility and talking with the people. We've seen one recently, obviously, a lot of it with Giuliani down in everywhere he could be. The visualness of that says a lot more than words ever could, and you get that. So where that's important in your plan, and that can help localize it again and get it to your audience, use that as best you can. It's always important, I think, in you're making a case, making a presentation to your publics, how you can use visual things to enhance whatever you're doing. That's pretty obvious. And so try to do that to emphasize your points and make your case with that. Finally, we get to something that that we've called Japanese. Now, when in Japan speak Japanese? You need to understand the culture of your local, when you localize this, understand the culture, or cultures if it's multicultural. To whom are you getting this whole process across? Do they really understand what you're saying? And can you need to understand where you are. Again, I think of an example of this out of work in my previous job when I was in Tokyo and I had the luxury of living there for 6 years. And one of the jobs there, I had a lot of administrative things in addition to all the public relations things. Thank you, Pat. And one day, I got a message from the home office. And it said, would you please give us an inventory, we need this for insurance purposes, of all the vehicles, the company-owned vehicles in Asia, broken down by the country. So I said, you know, big deal, and pushed, you know, the forward button. Sent this on to a fellow who worked for me by the name of Akira Kano, Kano-san, and sent this note to him. Well, about a week later, I got another note from the home office saying, where is this information? It's pretty simple. So I went over to Kano-san's office, and I walked in, and I said, Kano-san, where is this information? He said, Jackson-san, I've been here for 3 nights trying to get this. And I said, what? We just need this data. He said, no, I'm getting the maintenance records on every vehicle we have in every country in which we operate, because your note said, broken down by country. So you need to understand what are you communicating with people, and do they understand? It's very, very important to do that. And you need to bring that back to the culture and what's important to your publics. So with that, Pat, I don't know, do you want to go through and discuss both groups?
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you, Mike. Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left, and what I'd like to do is once again turn to the tables and let you have a discussion with your fellow practitioners at the table on really two things right now. What's in the way model, how we use the organizational family, and localizing everything. But really, this is a recap session for you to discuss some insights that you've had with the model that we presented in the applications. And I would also ask the table monitors at, I'll give you a cue, but at the last 5 minutes, we want to do a little research, okay? And this is called a plus delta. It's real fast. Just take a sheet of paper, and there's paper at the table. On one side, just put a plus sign. On the other side of the paper, the other half of the paper, put a triangle or a delta sign. Under the plus column, just put all the things about this presentation that you really liked and you wouldn't change. Under the delta sign, just jot down some things that you think we should do better or should change or should address differently. And that'll be a great, great way for us to get some quick feedback from you. So take some time. Talk about localizing everything. Talk about going to your organizational family. And then table moderators will help you in the last 5 minutes to do this quick plus delta research. And that's a great technique you can use with your own groups. It's almost immediate. Gets it done real quickly. So get going. Remember, if you want some information, get us your business cards. Write on the cards what you want. We'll make sure that we get it to you. You can give it to us personally or to the table moderators. All right, if we could just kind of do our final little plus delta. Remember, for PSRA, they really like to get the green sheets back. That helps them with conference planning. So take a minute to fill out your green sheets. And we want to thank you all for coming.